Afternoon. The Health Quality Subcommittee will please come to order. Melissa, will you please call the roll?
Chair Roberson.
Here.
Representatives Campbell, Diaz.
Here.
Gonzalez.
Right here.
Nelson.
Here.
Patronus.
Here.
Rader. Rollerson. Rodriguez.
Here.
Rooney.
Here.
Saunders, Spano,
here.
Watson is excused. A quorum is present, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you, Melissa. This afternoon, the Department of Health will be giving us an overview on the department's newborn screening program. This will be a short meeting for those who were in long meetings earlier today. It's important that we focus on this important program in our state, and it's a program that has saved the lives of many babies, and I think that's important. And we allow many babies to have a better quality of life through early disease detection and diagnosis. So with us again today is Deputy Secretary of Health, Dr. Celeste Phillip. And Dr. Phillip, welcome back. You're recognized for your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I share the sentiments, and I think last week we got here on a pretty timely schedule, so I'm committed to trying to break that record. And in a short amount of time, I think will be enough to convey the value of this program and all that we've been able to do for babies in Florida. So this presentation will provide an overview of the program as well as some of the recent updates. We'll have a list of the disorders that are currently being screened for in the program, and we'll have some examples of the impact of the screening program in the lives of families in Florida. So in 1962, there was a physician by the name of Dr. Robert Guthrie who discovered a very simple way of testing for elevations in phenylalanine, which is an amino acids make up proteins, which are in most of the foods we eat, very large part of our body composition. So they're everywhere. And the reason this was important is because in certain individuals who are born with a condition where they cannot process this amino acid, they have a buildup, which we call phenylketonuria, or PKU. And although the treatment is very simple, at that time, if you didn't diagnose it soon enough, it could have very severe developmental outcomes for these kids. So after his discovery, in 1963, there was a national launch of newborn screening, and in Florida, that began in 1965. So as you can see here, the overall goal is that we screen infants early for conditions that we know that we can treat. We also want to make sure that we are diagnosing in appropriate ways, meaning we have networks established and kids can get into care very quickly. So the process for collecting the blood sample is pretty simple when you think about all the other things that go on in hospitals. And I actually have a sample of the card. So there is a sample of blood taken from the heel of infants, and it's placed right over here on this card. And that is what is run at the lab to test for all the conditions that we'll be talking about shortly. Usually the blood is collected between 24 and 48 hours after birth, and our goal is to get those samples processed within 5 days. Hospitals also test for hearing as well as pulse oximetry for critical congenital heart disease, which I'll touch on in a minute. Abnormal results are followed up by the program office, and I want to talk a little bit about the difference between screening and diagnostic tests. So a screening test is something that we want where we feel confident that we're capturing everyone who has a condition. So the trade-off for that is that sometimes you may get positive tests in people who don't actually have the condition. So that is where we move to the second phase, which is the confirmatory or diagnostic testing. So once we have that group that has a positive test, we move on to the next phase where the testing is a bit more specific and helps us to determine, okay, who really has a condition, who does not, because treating when not necessarily is not a good thing either. So that's really the role of our program office, is to make sure that any child with a positive screen for the various disorders that we're checking for then gets the appropriate diagnostic testing and then into treatment if necessary. And in Florida, we do have a very extensive network of referral centers for some of these conditions that are not common. So this is an abbreviated list of the 37 primary disorders that we test for in Florida. As you can see, this is not meant to be inclusive of all of them. However, we could provide that if there's interest. At the bottom, you'll see critical congenital heart disease, or CCHD, which is the most recently added condition. And I'll walk you through our activities to move this forward. In Florida, we have a genetics and newborn screening advisory council who advises the department on appropriate actions for genetics for newborn screening. So in July, a group from this council, along with members from the Children's Medical Services Cardiac Technical Advisory Panel, came together and looked at how do we want to implement CCHD screening in our state. After the group met on three separate occasions, they decided that the best course of action would be for us to follow the national guidelines, and I'll talk a little bit about the national group that advises on newborn screening, to follow those guidelines, which consist of taking pulse oximetry, or the measure of the oxygen concentration in the blood, from two different sites, from the right hand and either one of the lower extremities, and using that as the way to determine whether or not there might be an abnormality that exists. In addition to that recommendation, the group asked to put together a summary document to give some guidance on what to do if you have a screen that looks like there may be something going on. And I want to assure you that most of the hospitals, we did a survey in November of 2012, and at that time, over 75% of hospitals were already doing the screening. So this is not something new, and many of us have probably had this done to ourselves or seen it done in hospitals. It's something that's very common. But the added layer is now we will be tracking better the outcomes, and from a population perspective or a state perspective, we'll now have better data to understand what exactly we're detecting, and also is there a way for us to seek out resources in certain parts of the state or have an assessment for our overall quality. So the summary document, just for an example, gives specific guidance that if there is a child that fails the screening based on the criteria, they are then placed under the care of a neonatologist. There is a cardiac echocardiogram or ultrasound of the heart that's done, and the infant is then referred to a pediatric cardiologist if necessary. So that's just an example of some of the guidance. Again, probably already being done, but now we have it outlined in a way that it's standard and everyone understands that there are resources that they can refer to if needed. The second part of the update refers to the data side, which is a big part of what we were trying to get at from a statewide perspective. So it will require some modifications to our current system, and our vendor is working on that. But the really nice thing is that we're hopefully going to have very soon a web-based portal so that the information can be entered electronically, which will be very nice. Most hospitals have most of their data systems electronically at this point, so I think that will help with getting that information in. Our go-live date for these enhancements is June 15 of this year. And again, I want to emphasize that we know it's being done in the majority of hospitals, but we'll now have a way to capture the data. So I've touched on the benefits of early detection a bit, and I just want to emphasize that for many of these conditions, the diagnosis within the first few days of life can really make a major difference between the severity of outcomes. And there'll be an example later on where I'll show how even a few days was enough for the provider to say, you know what, the screen is telling me that I need to do this. Around 2004, there was a recognition that Most states had some kind of a newborn screening program, but there was not a lot of uniformity. And you know, that's not that unusual. But in this case, it was recognized that that was creating a burden on some families that lived close to borders between states. So you live in one state, but the closest birthing facility is in the other state. So for a lot of families, that's where they would go. If the screening that's done in the state you deliver in is different from the state you live in, and one of the and you're diagnosed with a condition that's not really covered in your state, you can see how that might lead to some challenges with treatment. So at that time, the U.S. Health and Human Services convened a national group to give some guidance on how can we approach this in a more uniform way across the states. So this group, who consists of national and international experts, created what is called the Recommended Uniform Screening Panel, RUSP, you might see on some documents. And that came up with the primary or baseline disorders that were considered to be priority. In Florida, we do have additional disorders that we screen for that are not considered primary, but to be on the panel, we do have other criteria that must be met. There must be a reliable screening test to detect the disorder. And as I mentioned, that means it's a test that we know will capture most of the people that have the condition. A reliable diagnostic test, which is the next step to make sure we are capturing the people who really have the condition and not the people that don't. And then, very importantly, that there is treatment and long-term care available. And that may include access to specialists that will be responsible for the long-term care of the child. Florida Statute 383.14 created the Genetics and Newborn Screening Advisory Council that I mentioned earlier that works with the department to give us feedback. This council is made up of experts in genetics, endocrinology, pulmonology, primary care, parent advocates, hospital representatives, and others. So the national group that I mentioned a few slides back has recommended 31 primary disorders, all of which we do screen for. There is an additional list of secondary disorders that we also screen for. They're not talked about as much because they're not quite, the outcomes are not quite as severe, but we also screen for those, and that's an additional 26. This last bullet here talks about the challenges with SCID or CCHD, and SCID stands for Severe Combined Immunodeficiency. We are fortunate in our state that we have the resources, the infrastructure, and the support to make sure that we are screening for these conditions. And again, if they're caught early, can have night and day consequences for these children and families. In other states, there are challenges with resources. Some of it may be transportation. And because those states cannot ensure that they have that number three of the criteria, they have not gone forward with implementation. We fund this program through a combination of sources. We are able to bill Medicaid as well as private insurance for the lab testing. There's also a $15 fee that the birthing facilities pay for each live birth. And what we do with that funding is transfer it to ACA so that they can use that for the Medicaid match to pull down the federal dollars. And so this has been a way that we've been able to cover the cost of this very important program. We also have two federal grants for the hearing screening, and this helps to cover the cost of the follow-up testing. The final bullet refers to budget authority that the department has for the costs associated with the upgrades to the data system for CCHD tracking. All U.S. states and territories have newborn screening programs, as do most developed countries. Unfortunately, there are still many countries that do not, and you can, to this day, see the devastating effects of not having the screening program. If you're not convinced yet, I think the next few slides will further drive home the value of the program. In 2012, we had approximately 213 infants born in the state. This slide shows the spread of the conditions that were identified through the newborn screening program in that year. This is baby Alia. In October 1st of 2012, Florida implemented SCID screening. And as I mentioned, SCID is severe combined immunodeficiency syndrome, which essentially means the immune system is so dysfunctional that it's like having no immune system at all. If it's not identified early and appropriate treatment not initiated, most kids die before they turn one. So we initiated screening October 1st, and in less than a month, on October 26th of that year, the newborn screening program detected that Alia had SCID. So as you can see on the slide, she received the stem cell transplant from a donor who was a match and is currently doing very well. Mayer is a child who was diagnosed with PKU through the screening, and I referred to a case I was going to point out here. So if you look on the slide, you can see that the special formula for kids with PKU was begun at 6 days of age, even though the official diagnosis was not until 9. So there was some confirmatory testing that there was a bit of a lag. But because the screening is done so promptly, that gave the folks taking care of Mayer to say, you know what, it's so important for us to start this now. We're going to go ahead with this formula. Obviously, if the confirmatory test came back negative, then they could have stopped the formula. But you can see that it's so critical for some of these conditions to have that feedback very quickly. He is currently in second grade and is exceptionally bright. Jocelyn received her hearing screening on her first day of life when she was in the hospital. At that time, it was identified that she had some hearing deficits. She received the appropriate referrals. At the age of 4 months, she received hearing aids, was put into therapy. As of now, she has learned sign language as a second language and is developmentally on track with her peers. For hearing in particular, which you wouldn't think it would be easy to go for long periods without diagnosing, but when children are not verbal, sometimes you can go several months without identifying it, and that delay can cause a much longer delay in kids catching up. So again, early diagnosis is key. So in summary, Florida has been testing infants for almost 50 years with wonderful successes. Florida is testing for all of the disorders that have been recommended by the State Newborn Screening Advisory Council, as well as the National Advisory Committee. Out of over 200,000 infants born each year in our state, hundreds of babies with congenital disorders are identified each year. Their lives are saved because of newborn screening, and they grow up with the potential to be productive citizens with a high quality of life. Thank you for your attention, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Dr. Phillip. Members, any questions? Representative Prepatronis, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for that presentation. I'm a young father, and it's kind of one of those things where my wife, as she probably read 50, 60 books before the first baby was born, and spitballs the different tests that are going to be performed, the immunizations and all those that take place. With some of these tests that are performed, can you do like a snapshot on one of them, probably what has been maybe a realized cost savings and maybe what has happened maybe with infant mortality because of the particular test? I mean, spotlight whichever one you want. I'm just kind of curious. I'd love to go and tell her about how great this test was that we're making sure happens in our state.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Great question. when I mentioned the criteria about good screening programs, the return on investment is inherent to when we decide, yes, this makes sense that we should do this. So I want to emphasize that all of the disorders that are tested for through the blood testing, it's all collected at one time. And I know when you have a newborn the first time, they're taking your baby everywhere, they're doing all kinds of stuff, and it's a bit overwhelming, just along with the emotion of, especially if it's your first child. Usually that, as I mentioned, it's 24 to 48 hours, so hopefully it's after you've had time to bond and just kind of get over the whole experience. But in general, there have been studies where on the conservative end, the lifetime savings for conditions detected during this early period is about $500,000 for the lifetime per disorder that's caught early. Breakdowns by specific conditions, we can look and see if we have them, but that's the general amount that we talk about for newborn screening savings.
You're recognized for follow-up.
I want to pull up the page of actually all of the different tests here. So all of these tests, which I guess I just wasn't realizing, there's, I guess, the 37 tests, disorder tests, those are done with just a simple blood test?
Correct. So wow. This card I showed here, there's a prick, which obviously is not the greatest thing, but then the samples are placed on these little circles right here, and all the tests are run off of that. Now, the screening for hearing and the pulse oximetry, those are separate, but right. All the blood tests are from that.
Okay. One more. With some of these conditions, I guess the only one I'm probably really familiar with is I guess that can be a lifetime, like cystic fibrosis, but with some of these, the test diagnosing it that early at birth, is there also ability to cure because of that particular disease?
Thank you. Some conditions, there are very good treatments.
Okay.
For some conditions, there are options for what we consider a cure. For others, cystic fibrosis is still a condition where we've seen significant progress. The lifespan has been extended quite a bit in the last several years, but there are still some where there's not a definitive cure.
Gotcha. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Members, any other young fathers on the committee that would like to ask a question? Another? Okay. Representative Diaz, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I actually have a one-month-old newborn. So my question is in reference to the pulse oximetry. I know we had legislation last year that was going around in reference to pulse oximetry, but I don't think it was actually passed. So am I correct to think that this is now part of our standard screening in Florida?
Thank you. In December of last year, after the committee that I described had given us feedback on using the two extremities for the algorithm for the screening, we put together that information along with the document for the referral process and accessing resources, and sent that to the hospitals. I believe it was December 17th, if I remember correctly. So the hospitals have received that information. There will be more education that will accompany this process, as well as the data updates that we're waiting on. These cards, I think I forgot to mention, these cards that we use, we're already in the process of updating them to capture the information prior to the data system being updated. And, again, most hospitals are already doing this. It's more of a matter for us having a better assessment statewide with the data, but there will be some that it will be new for them to do it on a consistent manner, and we're here to work with them.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The two parts. One is if we can see the card up here so we can see it closer. And the other question is, also, in reference to pulse oximetry, it's non-invasive. So for the pulse oximetry, there is no need to draw blood or anything like that?
Thank you. I apologize. I meant to mention that. It's non-invasive. You're absolutely right. It's just a sensor that's placed on the skin to detect the level of the oxygen in the blood in that particular site. And for the protocol that we're using for CCHD, it's the right hand and then one of the lower extremities or feet.
Representative Spano for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Has there been any kind of a cost-benefit analysis that's been done in terms of how much we might be saving in terms of medical costs by, you know, testing early as it relates to the Medicaid program or even more generally?
You recognize?
Thank you. The return on investment, that number I quoted, the $500,000 on average per disorder, was for the lifetime. If you're talking about shorter-term costs, maybe around the neonatal period or the first year of life, I don't know if we have those costs per se, but I can check on that.
Follow up? One other question, Mr. Chairman. Do you have an idea of how many, what percentage of babies or infants are being tested as opposed to the number that are born? Just get some sense of, are we testing most, if not all?
Thank you. Parents can opt out of the testing. Most places, I'm sure, are very emphatic to say this is a really good thing. Sometimes it's difficult to track all of the people who opt out because we track the numbers by the number of labs that we process, and then we can cross-reference it with the number of birth certificates. But sometimes, despite that, there are a few that may fall through the cracks, if you will. But in general, the last time we looked at it, it was 99% that participated in that given period.
Representative Rodriguez for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your presentation. I was just following up on Representative Spano's question. in terms of quantifying the return on investment, specific to the Medicaid program, we heard the figure that you gave, which, you know, per disorder, but has it been quantified specific to when the Medicaid program is the one that's going to be responsible for a lot of those health care costs, which I imagine oftentimes is the case, given how catastrophic some of this can be?
Thank you. In Florida, over half of births are to women who are on Medicaid at the time of the delivery. So that's a very important question. I don't know that we have, I think we'd be happy to look at that, maybe thinking through how do we want to define the period of time that we're looking at. So, for example, for PKU, if we missed it for a month, could we estimate the additional cost that might result from the delay in treatment? And because there's so many different conditions, that might be a bit of a challenge, but I'd be happy to talk more about how we could approach that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And another follow-up is in terms of those newborns that aren't being screened, could you quantify that a little bit and tell us a little more about why that is, you know, home births or you know, where is it that you're seeing that, and if you could quantify that for us.
Sure. Thank you. As I mentioned, in Florida, we have over 200,000 births a year. The overwhelming majority are in birthing facilities that are either a hospital or a birthing center of sorts. With home births, there's still the option for the testing to be done. They would have to go in to have the blood drawn at a lab or another appropriate facility, but there's still that option. What we find is that there is, in some groups, there is a sense that I don't really need this. You know, if something were, there's some groups that still have a distrust of some of these programs. You have my information. What are you going to do with it? If we've identified that there are maybe a particular regional difference in how people perceive the testing, to try to work with that group to emphasize that this is being done for the purpose of finding these potentially treatable conditions in the infant early. But there are still some groups where you may have some of that resistance.
Representative Rader, did you have a question?
Oh. Recognize. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I might need a little help from Representative Rooney. But in our delegation, we have a woman who's come to almost every meeting for at least 5 years now, and she talks about her grandson who needed eye drops. I don't know, retinoblastoma. And it might be a little bit, I mean, and her big thing is her grandson had this and died from it. And she's always asking, why isn't this mandatory in the state of Florida for newborns, a quick test? And maybe you can talk about that a little bit. And if I didn't explain that 100%, maybe you can help me out, or maybe I did.
Clarify any of that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was actually just Googling that. That is scary that you were thinking about the same thing. It's retinoblastoma, and there's a woman. She comes in front of our delegation every year and makes a very emotional plea to get this for pre-screening, and I don't know if it's a cost issue or what, but it's when a child's eyes are red, when you take a picture of them, the retina is red, so that is the indication that the child has this condition. And if you got it early mm-hmm. enough, I guess it would be much easier to deal with it. But if it's too late, they're going to die. So that's what I think, you know, what we're talking about, what the cost or, you know, complication is with doing that type of screening.
Doctor?
The criteria outlined for what makes a good screening test, if I could just go back to that. So we have a test that will capture most of the positives, so it's a good test that's reproducible. It also means that there is a way to detect it, period. In some conditions, and the good news is that for some of these conditions that affect newborns and young kids, people are still looking at ways to better detect some of the very the conditions that have very severe consequences if not diagnosed early. For conditions affecting the eye, at this time, the best screening we have is doing the red reflex, which probably a lot of you remember that if you've had kids recently. And that's usually done very shortly after birth, and that just consists of taking a light and shining it in the eye in the dark, and you see it looks red, and that's the red reflex. That may or may not capture a lot of conditions related to the eye, and so that's identified as a problem. So to emphasize, for conditions to be recognized or recommended by the national panel, that they have very specific criteria that they use, and unfortunately there's still work to be done for many conditions.
Any other questions? Representative Ryder?
I guess not really a question, but just obviously the Palm Beach County delegation pays attention when people come in front of it. That's all I wanted to say.
Thank you. Okay. Representative Nelson, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Chairman. Do you have any idea what the cost for the federal mandated test and then what we do additionally for the state, the cost if you were to go out and buy that in the open market, or whatever you pay for, the hospitals pay to have that done, screening?
You recognize?
Thank you. I believe I do have some figures here. So I want to emphasize that all of the newborn screen lab testing is done at the state lab. So obviously we're all about efficiency, and because we have large volumes, I think that does enhance our ability to get a better cost per unit, if you will. I am not sure if I have that information, but I'd be happy to look it up and get back to you.
Okay. Follow-up?
One follow-up. And then what do all the medical carriers in the state of Florida then pay for all these tests under a current, forget about Medicaid, but for the Blue Cross or the Blues and Aetna and all those, do those carriers cover all of these tests?
Recognize?
Thank you. The overwhelming majority of plans cover the testing. There are occasions where there might be a copay, depending on how the insurance is set up. Sometimes for the hearing screening, I've heard we've had more challenges. It's a bit newer to the panel. and the hospitals try to work with the families if there is a higher charge for the hearing screening.
One last follow-up. Here so if a parents have a child at the hospital and they have Aetna or the Blue or whoever as their carrier, how would that testing get done? I mean, would the hospital say, okay, would you like to have these tests done, or would you automatically do it? How does that?
Thank you. The process is to say to the parent, these tests are recommended in all newborns. They collect a sample. It's sent to the state lab. We bill whatever insurance is appropriate. And at that time when the parent is being informed of the testing, that's the time they can say, I'm not interested, no thank you, and then they opt out of the program. If they agree to it, then we move forward in that process.
Thank you, Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Saunders, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is really fascinating, and I really appreciate the presentation on it. I was talking to two of our colleagues, Representative Kerry Pigman and Representative Karen Castor Dental, I think it was yesterday, and they were pitching me on a bill related to prenatal care and families who live in poverty in the state. And thinking about this program as a part of a broader continuum of prevention and treatment, my kind of two-part question is, just in general, over the course of these different things that could be diagnosed, how important is prenatal care to prevention of these? And two, does the data we collect upon screening tell us anything about which groupings of people in the state are more or less likely to be diagnosed once screened?
Thank you. Prenatal care has many benefits, some of which includes the ability to detect certain conditions before the baby's born. That gives parents time to understand what that condition might be. That gives them time to start thinking about how will they access appropriate treatment. Most of these conditions are not detectable before the baby's born, which is why, again, the time frame is so important, because you detect it and you move forward with that information very quickly. But obviously, with the other benefits that you get from regular prenatal care, we absolutely recommend early entry, first trimester, for the best outcome for mom and baby. And speaking to the differences that we see in different groups of people, we do know that there are some that are more likely to have late entry into prenatal care, which can cause some other issues, such as being familiar with what resources are available after the baby's born. We know for many of the conditions that we track that have a genetic link that there are certain groups of folks that have a higher risk. There's some conditions that are predominantly in only one group. So we have quite a bit of information with knowing what the risk factors are for certain of these disorders. But I would say with, for example, adding CCHD and us having that statewide database, that will really be interesting for us to see what some of those regional differences might be and also how we're able to provide the follow-up.
Dr. Phillips, I'd just like to ask you, is there any specific training the Department of Health personnel have to run this program, and are any of them, are they licensed healthcare practitioners, or what's the level of training that DOH, you know, staff has that runs this program?
You're referring to the program staff that assist with the follow-up for the positive screens that come
Well, in? Who actually, you know, you do the test results, you know, everything's done in Jacksonville. Who interpret, I'm talking about the people who initially interpret the results of the test.
Okay, thank you. So as I mentioned, all labs go to our Jacksonville location. It's actually a very impressive operation from what I'm told. I've not had the opportunity to go see it yet, but it is its own entity within that lab. So the folks that work with processing and making sure that the results are being read appropriately, they're very trained in the particular areas. I can get you specifics regarding if there are certain, is there a certain licensure that is required for any particular test. But because it's such a wide array, there are many staff that work, many FTEs that work particularly in this program.
Okay. And are they the first link to the parents if a test comes back positive?
Once the lab runs the test and gets the results are shared with our program office as well as the hospital. So it's our program office staff who are not in the lab who are the ones that are responsible for making sure the diagnostic testing and the other follow-up occurs.
Okay, thank you. If you could get us the information of who has the oversight and what their level of training is, and are they, you know, like a physician or MD, or who actually have oversight and what the level of training is, you know, we would appreciate it. You just get it to staff. So
we'll be happy to do that.
Members, any other questions? Okay. If not, is there any public testimony? Anyone here in the audience wishing to give public testimony? Okay. If not, Dr. Phillips, thank you again for being with us and coming back to see us. This is a very important program, and it's refreshing to see a program at the Department of Health is working well and saving lives and for the citizens of Florida. So thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Okay. And without objection on a motion of Representative Nelson, he moves we rise. The meeting's adjourned. Thank you.